In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. So on the front of your bulletin, this is not a picture of how Donald Trump would divide the world if he were to come into power. That's a lot of walls. Did I say that out loud? No, this is actually the game board for the game of Risk. Anybody ever play? Yeah, it's been about 25 years since I played a game of Risk because I have not had 8 hours of uninterrupted time in 25 years. It hasn't happened, right? So Risk is not an American product. It came from France. It came out in 1953. It was called La Conquête du Monde, the conquest of the world. And if you know anything about Risk, at the beginning of the game, everybody is divided a reasonably equitable distribution of territories and a relatively equitable distribution of armies. And it is your job or your goal to win the whole world through a strategic plan of advance and withdrawal. It's all about dominating. It's about dominating the world, or it's about either deterring encroachment upon your influence until you can dominate. It's about the end of the game is somebody is in charge of the whole world, which however we might want to slice it is kind of like life, right? Power is what infuses and animates pretty much every massive domain of human existence, in geopolitics, in business, in education, whereas we might like to think that certain other ideals are the pole star and the north star for any of those domains, let's just be honest. It's about power and about keeping it and about expanding it and about preserving it and about pushing back other alternatives to their expression or their encroachment of power. That's the way things are. But brothers and sisters, I think you would agree that what is true of the societal domain is also true of the individual domain. You and I have a problem with power when it comes to us not having it, and you and I have a problem with power when it comes to us having it. Any way you slice it, power is a problem. We're in a series on the Sermon on the Mount, if you're just joining us. And we are of the mindset that the Sermon on the Mount is out to do one thing from Jesus' point of view, and that is to reimagine life, the whole of life. And that includes reimagining power, what it is, what it's for, where it comes from. He's out to reimagine power for us. We're looking at the Beatitudes here on the beginning of his sermon, which line out the blessings that he intends for all people and the basis upon which we are to hear everything else. And the Beatitude we're going to consider today does not mention the word power, but it does speak of a quality, of a condition in which power seems to navigate. And so Jesus is out to reimagine for us true power. And so we're going to let this beatitude answer three questions. What is this true power? How do we come by it? And what's our responsibility to it? What is this true power? How do we come by it? And what is our responsibility to it? If you would stand for reading from God's word, we'll have it recited. Would you stand?
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
You may be seated. Nice job. All in the family. Words are like people. They change over time. New circumstances will force adaptations. And so what once was gets reshaped, gets reframed, gets revised. It's a fairly good bet that when you heard in this beatitude, blessed are the meek, you heard that word meek, a particular image or at least a fuzzy definition of meekness came to mind. And that sense of meekness likely involved an example of something like tentativeness, or timidity, right? Maybe you thought it had something to do with one who was introverted. Or as some people like to put it a little bit more pejoratively, mealy-mouthed. Right? Had to look that one up. Maybe it lacked any sort of pejorative sense. It's just sort of a neutral quality. You just thought of somebody who's meek as someone who's just mostly quiet and otherwise pleasant. And it would be understandable if you would make those associations with the word meekness, because that's pretty much what the word now connotes. But let it be said here at the outset, what Jesus means by meekness is not what you think meekness means. I do not think that word means what you think it means. It means something else. Jesus is hearkening to an older sense of that word, and in doing so, he is engaging in a whole discussion about power. How do I mean? You can see that even before we discover its older definition by just looking at the context of the Beatitude, right? For Jesus to promise to the meek that they're going to inherit the earth, which if you were listening closely, you noticed that that was exactly the quote from Psalm 37 in our call to worship this morning. Jesus is saying that this Beatitude has something to do with who will have authority when the kingdom of which he's spoken comes into its fullest and final glory. The context alone, what will the meek have? They're going to inherit the earth. So we're getting a clearer sense of what this meekness might mean. So what is it? What is this meekness? What does it have to do with power? Aristotle, remember him? A lot closer to Jesus than we are to Jesus, at least from sort of a philological point of view, from a study of words' meanings. He defined meekness as the quality that exists between being utterly irascible, just angry, upset, irritable, grumpy, and being incapable of being angry. That meekness lies somewhere between those two poles. So one who is meek is neither a hothead nor is someone who prefers to put their head in the sand. They don't pop off, and they don't take off. That's meekness. A pretty good definition whose origin I still have yet to pin down, and that Kevin and I found this week, was that meekness is defined as strength under control. Kids, guess what? You know what a picture of meekness is? Ferdinand the Bull, right? Big bull. Strong bull, right? When he sits on a bee and gets stung, he is moved to action, and he fumes, and he snorts, and he jumps, and he thunders. So he's got power. But when they try to haul him off to the bullfight, and they try to do everything they can to rile him up, nothing works. He just sits there. He's unamused. He's not willing to play their game. He just wants to sit under his cork tree and chill, full of power, but is not going to use it to entertain or amuse somebody else. That's strength under control. That's meekness. But Jesus is saying those who are meek will be part of the kingdom that he's putting in place. But to live in meekness is to understand power in a particular way, both when you're without it and when you have it. And so let's talk about both dimensions of meekness that sort of depend on the circumstance that you find yourself in. And first, let's talk about that context in which you find yourselves without power. Jesus saying about meekness this, that true power has to do with what you do in the face of powerlessness. You got to consider who Jesus is talking to and when he is talking. Israel is under Roman occupation. Any capacity to live out the full sense of their Jewish identity is always and everywhere under scrutiny and under constraint. His disciples are likewise under scrutiny. Everybody's wondering, are these guys out to revolt against Roman authority and therefore be accused of sedition? Or are they out to overthrow the Jewish religious establishment and therefore be labeled heretics? Which is it? Nobody knows. But because they're under the thumb, they don't have any power. And so whether you're an ordinary Jew in that day, whether you're a Jesus-following Jew, it's the same experience of constraint, of having little to no power, and therefore being without freedom in some important sense. No way to obtain a voice or a place, and no way to prevent what little voice or place they have from being taken away. It's like they are in a game of risk without any playing pieces. That's what it means to be in the first century Palestine if you're a Jew in Roman-occupied Israel. To that externally related condition, Jesus makes a promise. This: you're without power now, but in time, you will have authority when the kingdom comes in its fullness. The earth may be in myriad ways constrained and enslaved and misused, and with it you are likely caught in the jaws of injustice. But those days will not endure. A day awaits when you who have no power will have power, and more especially, you'll have freedom. Now, before we get too broad in a discussion of power, how does this idea of power actually relate to the words that Jesus has used? How does Jesus' idea of meekness figure in here? Meekness is about true power in this. True power has to do with poise and peace in the face of powerlessness. It's about how you respond to the realities in which you are without power. And so the opposite of meekness in Jesus' way of speaking is anger that bubbles up like acid in a cauldron when you are under the thumb of others and cannot get out from under. The opposite of meekness is despair at the endurance of powerlessness. Jesus here, in the first sense of meekness, is out to answer that anger or that despair that we might feel with the offer of hope that a day comes when our powerlessness will be overturned. And so meekness is that response to power when you're without it. Now, I got to be really careful right here. To say that meekness, as he's defining it, is acting with poise in the face of powerlessness is not the same as merely settling for when you have no power. You ever heard of that condition called Stockholm Syndrome? Right? It's this sort of psychological phenomenon among people who are under oppression that at some point they start to so sympathize with those who are oppressing them that they practically no longer care to be free of that oppression. It happens. It happens. People are held hostage, and after a while, they start to sympathize with their hostage takers. That's not meekness. Meekness is not pure passivity. It's not indifference to being without power. And that's why there may be no better or more fresher example of this version of meekness than what the United States saw during the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s. There was people without power who were often caught in the bite and the torrent of hatred. And rather than respond in anger or wilt in despair, they acted meekly as Jesus defines it here. They were without power, but they were still poised. They refused to retaliate, but they were courageous enough to sit quietly, receive blows, and answer hatred with kindness. All because they were hopeful of a day when they would, in a sense, inherit a new season with a new freedom. They faced their present day of powerlessness with that meekness that issued in neither fear nor despair. And you and I know very well that it was that form of meekness that served to overturn much of the power that was arrayed against them. Meekness has to do with true power, and true power is in responding with poise, with strength under control in the face of powerlessness. There's a second sense, though, in which Jesus is speaking of meekness here. And it has to do not so much with being without power, but how power is used when you have it. See, yes, true power faces powerlessness in a particular way, but true power also acts with power in a particular way. What do I mean? Remember when James and John and the disciples are walking on some dusty road with Jesus, because all the roads are dusty with Jesus there, right? They're on a walk together, and James and John walk up to Jesus and sort of furtively kind of throw Jesus the little card of, hey, when you come into your kingdom, can we be in the cabinet, right? Can we sit at your right and your left hand, they ask him. In other words, can we be your go-to guys, the first people you think of when you come to be in full charge? Could we do that? They're asking him for authority. They're asking him for power, right? And Jesus replies with a question. He says, are you prepared to drink the cup I will drink? That is, are you prepared to endure something like what he's going to endure? And they say, yeah, sure thing. And he replies ominously, you know what? You sure will. And then he makes this distinction between two kinds of power. After the rest of the disciples are indignant at James and John for being so full of themselves. Not so much because they take the high road, but because they wish they'd asked him first. And so what does Jesus say in reply? He says this, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise over authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be his servant. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. There's a use of power, brothers and sisters, that we're all too familiar with, that is all about trying to prove that you have it, or that you're trying to keep it. But Jesus is saying that there is a use of power that is ultimately out to serve, to be used for something other than its own sake. So Jesus is talking about power here at the individual level, at the level of the individual self. The self tends to crave power. It tends to use power to accrue more power to prove that it has power. But the other side of meekness is this. True power restrains the self so that it might act for what is greater than the self. That's meekness. Those great with power, Jesus says, are those who are great in service with that power. They don't glory in it so much as they glory in what the power can do for others other than themselves. And it's this way of viewing power that is the other side of meekness. It's this way of using power that fits with the kingdom to come that is characteristic of those who will inherit the renewed earth. True power restrains the self so that it might act for something greater than the self. That's meekness, and blessedness follows because it's that use of power that's going to endure, Jesus says. Now, maybe that sounds right and meat and full of goodness, and you probably nod your heads at that. I nod my head at that. But can you see how opposed that view of power is to how power is typically used? For instance, when's the last time you heard a politician say, I'm going to do the right thing even if it costs me my position and my party its influence? When has that ever happened? How about never? Right? Or if we want to get really honest, how do you see how some of what the church in America bemoans right now is due in no small part to the ways in which the church has sought to retain a cultural power at all costs, many of which were in direct contradiction to what it means to follow Jesus? Kevin wrote a write-up on a recent book written by Larry Tonton and his friendship that emerged with the late Christopher Hitchens, who was an avowed atheist, spoke rather acerbically and defiantly about things related to religion. And in that book, he references a moment in which Hitchens is speaking with Tonton and another Christian by the name of John Lennox, who's a good Irishman, who's a scientist. And Hitchens goes off saying, do you realize what the medieval church did in the way of oppressing culture, right? You know what they did, right? And at that point, Larry says, I know what they did, but do you realize that in many ways the church acted in direct contradiction of what Jesus would have taught? And Christopher Hitchens had never heard something like that, that the church might act in ways contrary to their founder. Robert Bella is a sociologist of modern day who says to the claim that religion is dying in the world, he says, only among white people. And he says, actually, in America, it's not on the dwindle. He says there's one exception, though, Europe. And though it's an oversimplification to say it's any one thing why Europe is experiencing such a dwindling in religious faith, but he does say, in large part, it can be attributed to the fact where state and church power were so aligned, and when that power became so corrupt, then inevitably those who looked upon the church as so cozied up with the state began to see that church has no authority. I will not listen. The world turns on the basis of who has power and how they use it. But brothers and sisters, before we start to say that the problem with power is all out there, and all in the massive context, do you see that this sort of dynamic can operate in the smallest domains of human existence too? In every relationship, there are times in which one must forsake their own power to do what is good, even if it costs them. In a marriage, if preserving your authority at every turn is your overriding goal, then you may win a lot of battles, but ultimately you lose. In the workplace, if your top priority is preserving your own power rather than investing power in others, you might retain your position, but it will often be at the expense of what the operation might be able to accomplish in its fullness. And isn't it patently obvious in parenting that if you try to maintain your power over your children from their birth to your death, you haven't helped them grow, you've likely stunted the growth. True power restrains the self that it might act for what is greater than the self. That's the way that's going to endure. That's the way that Jesus is espousing. That's the way that's going to inherit the earth. And Kevin reminded me of something this week. That's the way that God has always had in mind for humanity from the beginning. To have power, but in subservience to his interests for the earth. Power's not the problem. Power unbridled and unsubmitted is the problem. Okay, I've teased out two senses in which I think meekness is understood here. And you might have read the Beatitudes. You might have sat with "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth" last night for 20 or 30 minutes. And you might have thought, where's he getting all that? Right? Is he sort of just sort of covering all his bases rather than just sort of coming down on some definitive grasp of what Jesus means by meekness? That I'm perhaps adding more than what the text is really there. That's a fair question. It's a fair question to ask of any preacher. The reason there is room for both senses of true power in Jesus' meaning of meekness is that the most vivid illustration of meekness in the New Testament is Jesus himself. It's Jesus who describes himself with the very same word for meek. Oh, thank you. Okay. Gotta make sure. In our affirmation of faith from Matthew 11, right? Jesus invites anyone who would be his to take his yoke upon them and learn from him, for he says he is gentle and lowly of heart. The word in the Greek there for the word gentle is the same word that Jesus has used for meek in the Beatitude. So Jesus is saying of himself what he is saying of those who are blessed. Jesus calls himself gentle at the same time that he calls himself meek. And so the one who is meek, who invites us to take his yoke upon us, he is our way to discovering this true power, which is the second question we've wanted to raise here. How do we come by this power? If that's true power, if that's true meekness, how do we come by it? How do we be poised when we're without power? And how are we prepared to use it for what is greater than the self? We need him who embodied true meekness. He was meek in both senses we've outlined here. Let's just take them in reverse order. Jesus manifests true meekness in true power in the way he used it. He was not a weak or a passive agent. He did not just stand by and watch as injustice persisted. He didn't just sort of let condemnation fly. He speaks with courage and authority, often challenging detractors without hesitation. So meekness is not about going limp. He vehemently defends the healing of somebody on the Sabbath, despite the criticism of scribes and Pharisees. So again, this is not passivity. This is power in the service of love and mercy. This is meekness. He passionately excoriates those who would distort the purposes of the temple. And therefore, he's demonstrating that place between irascibility and the incapacity to anger. That's meekness. Jesus shows it. He knows what it's like to act with power for something greater than his own self. He was strength under control. Manifold moments came with him acting with power. But there is, of course, one moment in which he, if you will, stepped into powerlessness. He sat at table with one he knew would betray him. He let himself get arrested. He didn't run. When he was spat upon, he didn't spit back. When he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. He faced that powerlessness with poise that was more than an exhibition of virtue. It was powerlessness with a purpose. He died to set us free from the power of sin and death, brothers and sisters. He gave up his power among men so that he might act with power on behalf of those same men and of the men, women, and children in this room. Here was true meekness. Here was the meekness that kept him from an anger that might have inspired him to avoid his cross. Here was the meekness that kept him from despair that would have compelled him to flee his cross. Many have followed the example of Jesus acting with poise and peace in the face of powerlessness, but none have accomplished so much for so many through being meek for others. And it's what he accomplished for us that we have power not just reimagined for us, but transformed in us. See, brothers and sisters, when we see that he endured and prevailed over what has begun the dismantling of powers arrayed against us, even death, we find power to face our powerlessness. If we know that what is shall not always be. And we find the power to restrain ourselves in order to act for what is greater than ourselves when we see that it's his love, his power exercised in service that changes the hearts of many, which has changed the world entirely. And so I think the thesis of this beatitude is this: true power comes from trusting in his. That's it. You trust how he used it and how he didn't. And you believe that, and you embrace that, and then you will know what it means to live without power or with it. The power to be meek, as he means, will always derive from believing his use of power is not only right, but will inevitably prevail. So where does this responsibility to power begin as we learn it and receive it from him? Let me close with two little implications from this understanding of power, and it's this. First has to do with the first form of meekness about when you are without power. In some way and at some time, in some domain of your existence, you're going to be marginalized, you're going to be muted, you're going to be otherwise dismissed, and in that moment, you've lost your ability to act as you might. You will be without power. You will not be free. And that can be a lonely place, that can be an embittering place. And it can also be a place when you are provoked to cast off constraints in ways that are as dastardly as those you're trying to escape. What do you do then? When faced with powerlessness, you need to reconsider your fear and despair. You have to set that moment in the moment of his powerlessness and see whether your attempt to cast off restraint in the ways that you might be doing so really are an exhibition of belief in what he did to bring you his rescue and deliverance. Blessed are you who find yourself in the condition of needing to act with meekness. The trust in which you find hope in that moment is the same trust in which you will take joy in a later moment. You have to see your powerlessness in the context of his promises yet to come. That's your first responsibility to power when you don't have it. But what about when you do? When you have power, this is what you have to do. You have to look close, and you have to look sharp for the true ends of the exercise of your power. What are you out to do by way of your use of power? For every human act, there's a lot of motives that are beneath it. Some that are conscious and a lot that aren't. And for every human act with power, you can tell yourself it's for the greater good. But in truth, a lot of times it's mostly you just trying to prove something about you or establishing and increasing or preserving your authority. But blessed are you who are meek, who know the difference between acting for the sake of your own self and acting for the sake of something greater than yourself. In a marriage, in a workplace, in a classroom, as a parent, unless you use your power, aware that yours is always subservient to His, then you're going to be tempted to use it for its own sake or for your own glory. And whether it's because of fear or because of pride, you will exert your power not in a meek way, but in a marauding way. I know, I do, I have, I probably will again. Whenever you have power, you have to look close for the ends for which you exert it. So let me close where I began. When you have 8 uninterrupted hours, risk can be a really fun game, right? The role of domination, the rule of being the dominator of the world is kind of juices you a little bit, right? But in real life, brothers and sisters, we're always going to struggle with having no power or having power. And for as long as we live, we're going to wrestle with wanting to dominate or deter, and we will feel in us what the game of risk pulls from us. But true power, Jesus says, lies in meekness. And the one who manifested it best is the one who reigns and whose kingdom is sure to come. And it's here at His table that we're meant to find the strength to walk with true power. Brothers and sisters, are you feeling powerless today? Then I would invite you to come to this table and see why there is power and hope. Brothers and sisters, are you afraid or convicted that you're using your power for selfish ends? Then I invite you to come to this table and see where all our power comes from and what all our power is really for. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.